Hello, and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from Skepticamp 2024 and was recorded in front of a live audience in Manchester on the 18th of October 2024. A video of this, and many of the recordings hosted by Skeptics in the Pub online, are still available on our YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you would like to support what we do, you can join our Patreon. Find us at Patreon, Skeptics in the Pub, online.
Now, I'm sure you're all glad to see our last speaker is here. I can tell you no more than me. Very grateful not to be beatboxing. So I will hand you over to Ben.
All right, thank you. And first of all, I want to apologize for appearing before you, unwashed and haggard, but I've been putting up with British Airways for the better part of the day. So when I first conceived of this talk, I wanted to talk about how pseudoscience is still being accepted into American courts. But I don't think anybody in this room really needs it explained to them that, like, accepting dowsing or, like, the vocal analysis of how stressed somebody is in a 911 call is complete nonsense. So I decided to kind of go back to the root of the problem. And the root of the problem inherently that I found is that forensic science is not necessarily science. And what I mean by that is that it didn't arise out of actual existing scientific fields. Rather, it arose out of, or primarily arose out of, humans' innate propensity for pattern matching. So it was more, instead of being like, I know X is going to happen because I did Y, it was more, I have this skull, and I have an axe. Does axe A fit into slot B? So with that in mind, I decided to focus on a scientific field, a forensic scientific field, that has been in use for 2 centuries now, and it's the most American of fields, guns. More specifically, the field of firearm and tool mark analysis. So firearm and tool mark analysis actually got its start here, down in London, back in 1835. Apparently, back then, London didn't so much have a police force as it had, like, different gangs with slightly more legitimacy, which is kind of how the NYPD got its start, too, but I digress. Anyway, so the story goes that this guy called Henry Goddard, who was a member of the Bow Street Runners, was called in to investigate the murder of a homeowner. He ended up matching the lead ball to the mold used to create the ammunition for the firearm, and he matched a piece of paper found in the servants' quarters to wadding that was used in the gun. So it wasn't very scientific. It was literally, I jigsaw piece this evidence together. And now, 200 years later, that's still essentially what firearm and tool mark analysts are doing. So I've thrown up here, I'm going to give you a crash course in what firearm and tool mark analysts generally do. So what they're looking at is when a firearm fires, the breech face slams into the primer and it leaves a mark. So they're looking at generally 3 different things. They're looking at what they call class characteristics, which is like the shape the firing pin made when it smashed into the primer, or the ammunition of the guns. You can see it's 9mm. They're looking at subclass characteristics, which is like all the guns that were manufactured on the same assembly line probably have this marking. And they're looking at individual characteristics, which arose out of natural wear and tear or some kind of manufacturing imperfection that existed in that one firearm. So what they end up doing is whenever there's a crime where cartridge cases are recovered and firearm analysis is used, they collect those cartridge cases and then they have a suspect firearm. They fire the same type of ammunition out of that firearm as test fires, and then they literally use a comparison microscope, which is 2 microscopes duct taped together essentially, and they line them up under their field of vision and literally try to match up the striations between those 2 cartridge cases to see if they make a fit. And once they've done that, they can come to one of 3 conclusions. We have exclusion, where there's no way they came from the same gun. We have inconclusive, which is maybe they could have come from the same gun. Or we have inclusion, which is yes, they definitely came from the same firearm. And that last part is probably where some eyebrows are getting raised, because at no point have I mentioned anything involving numbers or statistics or any way to really back up exactly what their conclusions are based on, other than A looks like B. So the National Institute of Justice tries to explain this by saying that when a fireman toolmark examiner testifies, they'll usually say that, like, the inclusion, there's a practical impossibility that the cartridge could have been fired from any other gun. And they try to define practical impossibility as something that can't be expressed in mathematical terms, but rather was based on extensive empirical research and validation studies, such as, or that's part of the quote. But anyway, so to illustrate this issue of not having like actual science to back up your conclusions, we're going to dance over to my area of expertise for a second. I'm a forensic DNA examiner back over in the States, and I do this type of pattern matching as well. So up here you can see that we have two DNA profiles that match each other, and while I can say they match each other, because of testing that we've done on U.S. populations, I can also say that the probability of randomly selecting an individual that has this specific profile is about 1 in 110 billion. So remember, they tried to rescue this by saying there's been some extensive studies. Well, there's been two councils in the U.S. that have looked into these studies. We have the National Academy of Sciences report, which looked into 68 toolmark and firearm studies and found that there was a heavy reliance on purely subjective reasoning. And then in 2016, we had the Presidential Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, which found only a single study that actually met the criteria of adequately testing the field of forensic toolmark analysts. And they found, based on that study, that the false positive rate could be as high as 1 in 66, with a confidence bound indicating that the rate could be as high as 1 in 46. And that, I don't think I have to tell you, is way too high with the amount of cases that could potentially be affected. So I don't really have much time to go into like the where does this leave this, but suffice to say, confidence has been waning in the field, and there has been some judicial steps taken in the U.S. To limit the evidence that's being brought into courts. At the same time, some professional organizations, such as the Organization of Scientific Area Committees for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, have been increasing standards of best practice, because we actually didn't have a lot of those written down until way too recently. There's been new studies that have been done in line with the study the PCAST report found. And there's been study into using computer analytics that could potentially give us that type of number that I suggested when I was talking about DNA analysis that can be applied to this, because there's been some computer modeling where they actually layered over the actual surfaces of the cartridge case and like the breech fire or two cartridge cases compared together, and they have some kind of mathematical justification. But forensic science is currently stuck in a situation of playing skeptical catch-up. We've been using forensic science for centuries, but actual science has really only stood up and took notice of it about 5 minutes ago. Like, some of the standards that I was talking about when I was researching this talk were literally published just this last month. Yep. So people's lives are in the balance, and they may hinge on shaky practices of pattern matching and the perceived confidence of an examiner to a jury. And these practices aren't necessarily going to get hit pause while we figure things out unless a court specifically orders it to do so. So we're moving in the right direction, but we're trying to limit damage in the future, but we still need to repair some of the damage that we've already done. And projects like the Innocence Projects are trying to tackle this kind of thing where the defendant was convicted on potentially faulty evidence, but nothing's really going to beat getting it right the first time. All right.
Thank you very much, Ben. And now on to our final Q&A session of the day.
All right.
So we will start with Phil. How much do you think that many police TV shows influence society's trust in these technologies?
So that's a funny thing. We actually have a term for that in my field, which is the CSI effect, which is that juries see this stuff on TV and they think, it's going to have to happen the way I see it on TV. Like, you know, I can solve this crime within 22 minutes. So they expect a lot more, rigorous and, potentially damning evidence introduced in a court that may not actually exist, which increases the problem in twofold. It puts more pressure on us to say things that we're not necessarily saying. And in the case of these firearms examiners who aren't using any kind of math that can lead to follow-up questions in court, it becomes this kind of perceived confidence where, you know, the jury is just like, oh, they put it in the magic box, and the magic box says that, you know, he did it. So, it's a huge problem, the public's general understanding of the limits of forensic science.
Moving on to a question from Jonathan. Are there ways to rescue some of these forensic disciplines and make them more scientific?
That's a great question. So one of those ways was when I showed very briefly that kind of computational analysis where it's kind of adding some kind of actual evidence into it. We're actually mapping the surface of these cartridge cases, and we're providing some kind of statistics of just like, this is the likelihood that A matches B, essentially, as opposed to, looks similar. But in my opinion, a great way of rescuing these types of pattern matching is we limit or just outright don't use the inclusion part. Because exclusion can still be handy. Like when you saw when I put up those two cartridge cases where the firing pin mark was clearly a different shape between the two, like even a layperson can say that. And if that's the case, that is good evidence to be introduced into a court.
Moving on to a question from Evan. Don't American courts defend loose data by saying that good police work already went into finding the suspect gun? Good work like eyewitness ID. Oops, never mind.
I mean, maybe they try to justify it, but I mean, in actual practice, a lot of the time, the inherent problem with evidence being introduced into courts is that the police work isn't as good as they might lead you to believe. And honestly, a lot of the times, crime scenes are not being investigated by, like, crime scene investigators who are trained to actually collect this evidence, and instead, like, collected by police officers who have the potential to, like, introduce contaminating factors or their own DNA in evidence and things like that. So while I can't call them out on the stand if they throw me up as an expert witness, say I'd like to.
And we will move on to our final question of Skepticamp, which has to have come from Igor.
Waiting for it.
The older I get, the more of totally working ways of forensic analysis turned out to be bogus. Can we even know anything about anything?
Okay, well, I mean, yes, but you've kind of like hit the nail on the head of the problem that I said in my last slide there of playing skeptical catch up, which is we just kind of assumed certain things worked because they made sense, but we are actually doing some kind of scientific investigations into a lot of these things. They just have happened like very, very recently, like great strides in like standards that have been applied to broad swaths of forensic science have developed since I graduated grad school 4 years ago. Like a lot has happened in that time. So a lot of it is we need extensive studies into these practices that give definable error rates. We need new technology that might actually increase the reliability of the evidence that were introduced in court. So yeah, we can know if anything's really real. The problem is it takes work.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ben. So that is sadly the end of Skepticamp. I will once again ask you to join our Discord server. So that is Skeptics in the Pub Online's Discord server. This runs throughout the year, has things on there all year round, but also will be a massive communication tool over this weekend where you'll be able to see bits and pieces of information on there and chat to other attendees.
Big thank you to all of our speakers, you lovely audience, all of the Skeptics in the Pub Online team. Give it up for them, right? See you all later on, folks. Thank you.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub Online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.